Since this is the perfect spot to learn.
Teach me tonight. Teach me tonight. Frank Sinatra.
Starting with a.
Welcome back, Weekend Warriors. I'm so excited to have our next guest teach us about the musical aspect of what I believe we saw in Game 7. Players communicating without words, and LeBron James, the student, being the teacher. To me, it's Dick Dale and Leo Fender and Dwayne Allman and Eric Clapton making Layla. How close am I to the target? We're about to find out. The great Harvey Kubernick joins me right now. Harvey, thanks so much for waking up early and joining us.
How are you, Dr. Clapper? I'm just delighted to be here.
Well, we can't wait to pick that encyclopedic brain of yours about the music world. So tell us, I mean, the Beatles, we always knew there was the fifth Beatle, George Martin. I had no idea about this Tom Dowd guy who everybody recognizes as this physicist, mathematician, but what an incredible music producer who put together Layla. So tell us, I'm almost going to give you the five names, and I just want to let you run with it, of your stories and knowledge about Tom Dowd, Eric Clapton, Dick Dale, Leo Fender, and Dwayne Allman. So go ahead.
Well, I either pretty much met most of them or interviewed most of them as well. And, you know, Tom Dowd is the equivalent to Curlin and Job in your world. People forget that. Because the engineer, for many years, was sort of viewed as maybe a chiropractor by the medical association. Sometimes their names weren't on albums. But people like Tom Dowd, he helped invent and pioneer the 8-track recording device at Atlantic Records. He kind of helped build, and they had the first 8-track machine, which means there could be overdubs and more studio time to overlay instruments and stuff like that. If you examine this relationship, as you're pointing out, the components of Dick Dale and Dwayne Allman and Eric Clapton and Tom Dowd and even Leo Fender, and it's only because I've devoted my whole life to music the way you've done it, to music and medicine, and I've been fortunate, you know, since 1972, to interview the people I want to interview, but I just didn't interview the lead singer or the famous people. I would go to recording sessions and meet the engineers and the second engineers and the assistants. And you know, in your own operating room, sometimes the interns end up having patents and devices to change the world too. Correct?
Right. Yep. Absolutely.
So, so follow this one in your audience, which is so knowledgeable on the merger of sports and music. There was an already psychic and almost telepathic relationship between Tom Dowd, and a physical relationship between Tom Dowd, Eric Clapton, and Dwayne Allman before Layla started. As Ram Dass, the teacher and philosopher, says, honor the incarnation. So I'm about to tell you some stuff which might fully explain to you why you are just drawn to Clapton's playing or Layla. I mean, I know you play his music in the operating room.
Right.
So I'm about to give you some insights just because I had to do the tracking of this stuff. Things are sometimes predestined. Sometimes there's magic. Sometimes there is, the poet writer Mick Vranich came up with this term, geopiety. Kind of geography and God kind of merge together. So it shouldn't surprise you and your music and sports fans that Tom Dowd had already, you know, worked with Dwayne Allman before the teaming with Eric Clapton on Aretha Franklin records or Wilson Pickett records, where Dwayne Allman played like on a cover version of Hey Jude. That brings your Beatle thing into it. Now you're really having your mind blown, aren't you? Okay. And so, and also understand that they've all kind of played, I would never say AAU ball, but they've already played a championship, Duke and North Carolina, or I'm a Pac-12 guy. I mean, they've already played at Cal, Stanford, and UCLA levels before they played each other. For example, Eric Clapton is in Cream, they're on Atlantic Atco Records, and they've used the Atlantic studio with Tom Dowd. I mean, even as early as 1967, when Cream is recording around Disraeli Gears, Eric Clapton does an overdub on an Aretha Franklin Lady Soul album. Okay, so he has a relationship with Tom Dowd as a drop-in session guy. Tom Dowd already knows the Allman Brothers because they're sort of on a Capricorn Atlantic related. They all have the same lawyers, sometimes management. They're all involved in the same distribution network of their product. They've either shared gigs or seen each other play. So they have all this commonality there until Eric, you know, Dwayne says to Tom Dowd, you know, they all go and see each other play one night. As I seem to remember, Eric Clapton and they were recording in Florida at Criteria Studios, studio very important. They see the Allman Brothers play, and then the invitation, and Dwayne says, I'd love to come to session as a fan just to see, you know, Eric and everybody record. And so it all kind of comes together, but people like Dwayne Allman spent a lot of time in L.A., at least 8 months or a year, 67 to 68, when they had Almond Joy or the Hourglass, and had played in Huntington Beach and places like the Golden Bear, and had heard Taj Mahal's band do Statesboro Blues, and sort of got steered more into that slide guitar, bottleneck guitar world. And Eric Clapton is a fan of that blues style as well. So it seemed almost, because of Tom Dowd, who is like John Wooden to people. I mean, there's a documentary on him. Go look it up. I met him during the Rod Stewart Atlantic Crossing sessions, and I asked him all these questions. And the engineers are always happy to talk to you because they're the neglected sixth man on the bench.
Right. Wow.
Does this all make sense to you?
Yeah, I want to ask you a question.
There's roads that lead to the moment that you covet.
What are they talking about when Eric Clapton says he bent strings and Dwayne Allman did something different with the strings? How many different things can you do with a guitar string?
Well, Dwayne Allman had the luxury of being in bands with his brother probably since age 11. He knew how to be in bands. He knew how to be a session man. And he knew how to play with other groups as a guest on occasion. He became a slide player, but also employed like bottleneck techniques, meaning like actually taking a bottleneck as a slide instrument to get that wiry, kind of crazy, almost bird sounding that you like on Layla, that wild slide. Some of it's out of tune, but a lot of slide work is out of tune. Eric Clapton was more, I mean, I could give it to you in sports. Dwayne Allman was the 3-point shooter that was brought in. Even though the ABA only had that rule, you know, when this record was recorded, he was the 3-point specialist who could take the guitar further, because a lot of rock and roll records, and I'm talking pop records, records that were hits, you didn't really hear a lot of slide work. It was kind of an exotic, erotic instrument, and program directors and radio people didn't want to hear some 6-minute crazy slide work with birds chirping at the end with piano. I mean, that was pretty out there stuff for AM radio, but it became an FM radio for a while. Eric Clapton knew how to improv, knew how to play guitar parts, knew how to bend strings, meaning he could expel the instrument, he could use it in restriction, he could, because he also had to plug in Cream, he had to plug in with the trio. Now, in Derek and the Dominoes, and I saw them play live at the Pasadena Civic Auditorium in 70, maybe, or 71, he knew, he was, with Derek and Dominoes, he was sort of like the way Jerry West and Bob, the general manager of the Golden State Warriors, put together a team where 8, 10, 12, 14 people would all be playing, because Derek and the Dominoes was a first time Eric Clapton stepped back from a hardcore leader role and wanted to be in a group. In fact, there are hidden elements like your J.R. Smith guy, like Bobby Whitlock in Derek and the Dominoes. He co-sang vocals on a lot of the songs. I think he probably co-wrote at least 6 of the songs. And so people like Tom Dowd, who had worked with the great Sam and Dave R&B trio, you know, where there was unison vocals, you know, male and male, you hear Eric joined by Bobby on vocals as well, so it boosts the vocal, and then you also get to hear all these great fluid guitar work. So that's why you play it in the operating room.
Harvey, when Tom Dowd says, this is was like the greatest thing about it, he says, listen as he teases out the different components, Duane Allman and Eric Clapton in Layla, he says, listen here, and he's in the producing room so he can tease out all the other sound effects. He says, these are notes that aren't even on the guitar. This is only created by their touch on the strings. Other people can't make their guitars sound this way, just they can. What is he talking about?
He's actually talking about stuff that you employ in your medical routing. I mean, Tom Dowd, by the way, had sound patents very early, and like a Leo Fender, somebody, he came out of rocket science as well. You're dealing with a mathematician kind of guy. At the time Tom Dowd is giving you this darshan, these instructions, remember, he is a guy that had worked with Ray Charles Records for Atlantic, for Nisui and Ahmet Ergun, and the producer Jerry Wexler. He comes out of R&B and horns. He comes out of groups. He also comes out of people like Ray Charles who have female background singers. So he understands all the components of sound. Now, I admit it is not quite rock and roll, and there's not a lead guitar, but there is a guitar player with horns. So when he talks about the magic in the fingertips, even with an 8-track machine back then, a lot of the principal recording on the tracks is done live in a room with the four guys, and then there may be a piano overdub by Bobby Whitlock or an overdub by you know, Duane Allman after the tracks are laid down, or playing live as well. That's why people like you relish the music of 1956 to about 1972. Because it was more organic. There were four and eight track machines. People played together and you had to do it on the spot.
Yep.
I mean, now people record in other countries on records. And so there was such a commonality. Plus they had a shorthand. Tom Dowd, remember, they've all played the Fillmore Auditorium. So I'm talking Clapton and Duane Allman. Tom Dowd has recorded live albums at various places. He's the Atlantic house staff engineer going back to the 50s. That's why I compare him to Wooden. I mean, I knew John Wooden a little bit. He brings, like Curlin and Job, they bring in techniques that still have changed the world 40 and 80 years later, although they very rarely get the acknowledgement.
Amazing.
Because we have a star system that is focused on lead singer or the lead guitarist.
Gotcha.
But we all know this rock and roll, when it works, it's a team concept.
Gail, I got about a minute left. Tell me about, not so much Dick Dale, but Leo Fender. Who is this mad scientist? Did you ever meet Leo Fender?
You know, it's funny. I was around him around 1973 when he sold his company to Columbia Records, but I wasn't paying attention to guitar players there, although I recognized that friends of mine had to always get Fender guitars and original models and all that, and they'd sock all their money on this stuff, and I didn't quite get it at the time. Now, Dick Dale, I saw play live in the 60s. I saw him play the Surfer Stomp 73 in Hollywood.
The guitar is upside down and backwards.
Yes, well, he did some usual things, the way you talk about urging people. Either it's, you know, plastic hip replacements or metal, and he went against convention. But also, he was the opposite. Like the way we like the way LeBron micromanages the team on the floor and coaches and looks for spots, and you've seen him do this kind of thing. Dick Dale was the exact opposite. He was a wild man who played percussion. I mean, I think I saw him in March of 64 at Pacific Ocean Park doing Mizzer Lou and Let's Go Tripping. He did a version of Havana Gila I Wish Was at My Bar Mitzvah. Because he was wild, and he also was playing to 1,000 to 4,000 people that had to be unleashed. And remember, he is showing up before the Beatles come to town.
Wow.
There was very much nothing like him, and now you know why he had such a big influence on the Ventures or Jimi Hendrix and even the instrumentation. And Leo Fender is sort of his guiding light mentor, like a John Wooden, saying, here's some amps, here's some guitars, And it was a world of trust. Dick Dale wasn't some paid endorsement guy with a sneaker deal.
Right.
It was both people helping each other out, expose instruments and amps, which completely inform everything we all listen to.
Mm. Harvey, you're amazing. You're amazing. Thank you.
You're amazing eating at the pantry every week. That's amazing.
Listen, I could talk with you for hours, and we're going to have to make this happen again, but thank you.
Always available, you know that.
Well, I appreciate it, and we all appreciate it. Just having you around this encyclopedia of music, it's just such a key thing to now understand. The eyes don't see what the mind doesn't know. For you and us, we don't hear what we don't know. Thanks to you, we get to know a little bit more. I really appreciate you waking up early with us today. Thanks so much, Harvey.
Anytime, Dr. Clapper.
Okay, appreciate it. That's the great Harvey Kupernick. He's written so many books. Go online, read his books. They're incredible because he's been there and he interviewed these people before anybody else thought of it. You're listening to the one and only Weekend Warriors Show every Saturday morning. Welcome back, Weekend Warriors. The Twisted Sister. Oh, those years with the big hair. Oy vey, I remember that. You know, last week I was talking about the Kreplach chicken soup at the best deli in L.A., Canner's Deli. And who calls in but Mark Canner? I talked about Philippe's. Who emails me? The owners of Philippe's. I talked about Dr. J and the Rock the Baby Dunk. And who called in but Keith Erickson, who called it with Chick Hearn. Well, guess what? Right now, what a treat it is. The great Ryan Hollins is calling in. Ryan, thanks so much for calling in. I appreciate it.
Hey, Doc, you are one of my favorite listeners. I love the show.
Thank you.
You are the man. I privilege to call in, man. Listen, you are my guy. Dude. This is magic for me, Doc.
I'm not saying this just because you're calling in, but I am a big, big fan of yours because you have perspective.
Don't tell me that.
You have perspective. And when I hear you on all the different shows, be it ESPN, Fox, wherever I can hear you, when they talk to you, you represent UCLA the best because you're an intelligent guy who's in sports and the perspective you have, just like Marcellus. You guys have an ability, because of your intellect, to take us into the locker room, into the mindset of the athlete, which is the best. The game actually becomes secondary. I want to talk about before the game happens and analyze it afterwards, and there's nobody better than you, Ryan Hollins, so thank you. It's a great joy to hear from you.
You just gave me chills, but I'm calling for a reason.
Okay.
I got two Clapper questions that only you can pick. I got a personal one, and I'm going to go into the doctor's office. We're just going to share it on the radio, and then I got a one for the NBA playoffs, and I'm sure you've broken it down already.
Yeah.
So my left ankle, when I was in Memphis, I had to play through an ankle injury because I couldn't afford to sit out. And I've never had ankle problems, but I can't seem to get the same mobility back in my left ankle. A big deal? No. But I just feel like it could possibly create more problems there. Do you think I have a buildup in the ankle, or is it more stretching I need to do? How do I fix this, Doc?
Okay, so let me give you some clap revision here as well. Are you ready? All right, so
yes.
I'm assuming, and you got to correct me if I'm wrong, that we're talking about the big toe versus the little toe side of your ankle, that we're talking about the little toe side of your ankle.
How did you know that? I swear, I didn't even say that. How did you know that?
Right. So because I have clapper vision, I can see right through the radio.
Wow.
Now the way, whether you believe in God or not, but the reason I love surgery so much, the reason 30 years, 500 surgeries a year, see 100 patients a week, 15,000 people I've opened up. The reason I love it so much is you can work at Jet Propulsion Labs all you want and make rocket ships. There's no more beautiful engineering design than Ryan Hollins' ankle. Because that structure is so filled with contrasts. Meaning, you have the ability to have it locked and stable so it doesn't dislocate. But at the same time, you have the opposite, which is mobility. How do you have a hinge and yet it can move in all different directions, all different planes of freedom, flexing, extending, rotating, lateral bending? The way it works is the big toe side of the ankle, the medial side, is where the hinge is. That's why when you feel that medial side, the big toe side of your ankle, the lip off of the shin bone, the tibia, locks the ankle in and it's full on, behaves like a hinge. However, when you walk on gravel and you walk on sand, you can't use your car with four tires. You need a tank so that you have the, I don't even know what that stuff is called, under the tank so that it can go over sand and rock. A tank can go anywhere. It's not like a tire which can spin out in the sand, a half track or whatever it's called. You have that ability.
Yeah, yeah.
So you need in your foot 26 bones behaving like gears of a half track so you can deal with different kinds of terrain. Well, you can't accomplish that with a hinge. You need flexibility. You need movement. And that is why there's an extra bone that we have that is outside the shin bone, the tibia, and that's called the fibula. So the little bone that you feel when you tap the outside, the little toe side of your ankle, that's the fibula. Now, because the bone is so locked in as a hinge on the big toe side, the medial side, all we need is one thick, fat ligament connecting those bones. However, on the lateral side, the little toe side, where your issue is, you don't have one ligament that attaches the joint and gives it stability and motion. You have three. And it looks like, here's the clap revision. Take your fingers right now and make the number three. Not an okay sign like they do when they shoot three-point shots.
I'm doing okay sign.
Right, right. Don't do the okay sign. That's another way to do a number three. I'm talking pinching your thumb to your little finger. That's how you say the number three, other than when you make a three-point shot, Steph Curry. Well, when you do that, I want you to look at those three fingers. That is literally, now take your hand and point downward. Those three fingers, your index, your long, your ring finger, as they go north to south, straight down, that is literally how the anterior talofibular ligament, the posterior talofibular ligament, and the calcaneofibular ligament, the three ligaments on the side of your ankle, is what gives you stability. And way back when in Memphis, this is what you did.
Yeah.
You ripped. That's why it got swollen. It looked like a golf ball in your ankle. You ripped the anterior talofibular ligament, the one in front, the one closest to the front of your foot. That one tore. And it bled, which is what the body needed to do to heal. But here's the problem. It healed, so you don't have pain anymore. The swelling went away. But your ankle healed slightly longer as a ligament than it started. So let's say it was 2 inches long as a perfect size. You went and ripped it in Memphis. It snapped. It bled. It got swollen and it healed. And now it's 2.25 inches long. That quarter inch, because it healed slightly longer, is what gives you the feeling of now stiffness. But your body created all this excess scar tissue to try and compensate for it. Cam Newton needed surgery. He hurt his ankle like you in college. It wasn't until he was a pro he had to have ligament surgery on his ankle. Same thing with Steph Curry. You're dealing with that. Now, you're not doing to your ankle like you used to do in your playing days, so you don't necessarily need a ligament reconstruction. What you can work on now is trying to break up that excessive scar and stiffness that you have. And the way to do it is by being elegant with a bike, but where you put the balls of your toes, of your feet on the pedal. These are holistic ways for you to be able to bring motion. And it is not too late for you to benefit, Ryan, from a good physical therapist to show you elegant exercises to help you. They can do ultrasound and stuff you can't do on your own as well. And you might find all these years later, significant improvement in how that scar behaves. Don't let them do cortisone shots or any stem cells or other crap in there. Stay away from that. but modifying your exercise routine to help bring the scar and remodel it would be an excellent thing for you to do. So, Ryan, you made my day by calling in. Oh my God, this is fabulous.
Oh, I'm gonna talk about this for the next month. Like 3, 4, 5 weeks at a time, Doc. You know it, man. You just made me smarter. I appreciate it, man. There's always something, man. I'm getting excited every time I listen more and more, man. I appreciate it, Doc.
Thanks so much, Ryan. Have a great, blessed day. We appreciate it. That's the great Ryan Hollins calling into the Weekend Warrior Show. What a pleasure. All right, the clinic's open. You're listening to the one and only Weekend Warrior Show here on ESPN LA 710. I'm joined now in studio by one of my favorite comedians, the great Jeff Garland. Jeff, thanks so much for getting up early to be with us on a rainy day here in Los Angeles.
It's my pleasure. I want to say, you mentioned that I'm joining you now. I've been here the whole time. I've been sitting and watching you. And I thought this will be a unique appearance where I never speak. And I'd go with it, whatever it is, man. It's your show.
No.
If you want to play sound bites, it's all good, man. And you got your Laker Skull Candy headphones.
Yes, a gift from Skull Candy.
Well, that's very kind of them.
And I am on ESPN because of my obsession with what Jerry Buss put together in bringing the Lakers to the height that they're at. It's more than the Lakers. It's what he did with this team. And that's why I'm on ESPN.
Okay.
Make sense?
Sure. Sure.
The great Steve Paulette, I thank him for being with us today because he put together all these sound bites. But I want to go back in time with you.
Okay.
Here's the Jimmy Durante. Just him doing some shtick with Jack Benny.
My favorite all-time comedian, Jack Benny.
Really? So we have both of them here.
Yeah.
This is like, you're the Torah, okay? No, this is the Torah and you're Rashi.
Yes.
You're going to be analyzing what's in the Bible here.
Yes.
These two guys.
Yes.
Okay, let's get started,
right.
Huh?
Right. Wait, are you going to wear that hat?
Why, when they buy Durante, they buy a package deal. And this shampoo comes with the package.
But it doesn't look right. Leonard Bernstein wouldn't wear a hat.
If I had his hair, I wouldn't need a hat.
All right, suit yourself.
What is going on there that is beyond those words?
What's going on there is joy, knowing for both of them, both Benny setting him up and him delivering it, it's the joy of knowing these are good jokes and I'm going to have fun telling them. When I'm filming Curb Your Enthusiasm, sometimes one of the other producers would come up to me and whisper something in my ear because they, you know, don't want to say it out loud first to spoil it. And I'll either say yes with great enthusiasm or no, I don't think so. And if it's yes with great enthusiasm, what's exciting for me is knowing full well that it's going to work. See, I know it's going to work before I even say it.
Wow.
Yeah. And so there's great joy in that. There's also great joy in when I'm doing stand-up, which I mostly improvise. Sometimes a thought will pop into my head, and I know, oh, this is good. I can't wait to say this. I really have that whole process going on where I know I'm adjusting my microphone.
Yeah,
I'm good.
Don't worry, I can fix whatever you break.
No, I'm all good. Yeah, okay, yeah. Well, I probably will break something in here. That's me. But, the joy of, it's all about joy. That's everything. And that's me seeing Jimmy Durante as an 8-year-old. I'm seeing Durante filled with joy. But what's even more powerful is seeing the people in the audience looking at their faces filled with joy and anticipation as to what he's going to do or say next. That caught me. As a little boy, I always watched comedians on TV, on Ed Sullivan, Johnny Carson. a variety show here and there, you know. And I love the comedians, but you never saw the audience's joy. And so being in a room with the joy blew my mind.
Leonardo da Vinci, later in his life, was obsessed with the things in life that are invisible. Mm-hmm. So he concentrated at the end of his life on wind and the effect of wind on the ocean. He was obsessed with the things in life that you couldn't see, but you knew they were there. Mm-hmm. So you can't see wind, you can just see a tree. And as a painter, he focused on that. When I hear you talk about joy, it's almost like it's a rock that Jimmy Durante is holding. He has the joy. It's a rock. It's a physical thing. And now he cracked it up into 10,000 little pieces and giving pieces of the rock to each and every person in the crowd. It's,
right.
It's almost like you see joy. It's invisible, but it's visible to you.
Yeah. And that's what you want to do. You want to give out joy. I actually look at my job, no kidding around, that my job is to ease people's pain. That's truly my job. It's to ease people's pain because life throws you a lot of curveballs. And those curveballs a lot of times are great pain. And to have a TV show, comedian, a movie, just something where the pain is not getting at you is a fun thing to do.
It's tremendous. You're totally right. For me, it's the greatest medicine that I can use. 6 cases yesterday. The poor nurses have to hear me say the same spiel to each one of these 6 people. But like you, it's a different audience,
yep.
right? So
yep.
I tell them, don't forget, my dad was a carpenter. He taught me to measure twice, cut once. Is your wife going to be here after the surgery? Yeah, I hope so. Well, let's hope she's not in the Beverly Center. This could be a very expensive operation. I've told this joke like 15,000 times.
Right.
But I believe, Jeff, you're totally right. I don't care what that anesthesiologist is going to give that patient before their surgery. Nothing is more powerful than me making them laugh before they're about to have a hip replacement.
Nothing is more powerful. It puts them at ease.
Wow.
That's it. I know because I've had surgery.
Yeah.
And you are it's a very vulnerable moment pre-surgery.
How about the power in being up there all by yourself? In front of a crowd of 100 people, 10,000 people, on TV, in front of millions of people, the power that you... Do you start to see the audience as a single mass, as a single group where the laughter goes up and down, or do you see it individually? And do you sometimes find a face in the crowd, and they become the one-on-one audience?
Okay, a couple things. First off, I try not to think about it. You know, I try not to analyze any of it, and I know you love doing that. but the crowd is an entity. Mm-hmm. It's definitely a one thing. And in terms of individuals, it's really funny. You find the one face that's not digging it.
Really?
That's what you do. You find the one face that's not digging it. And you're almost like, what's wrong with you? Look at everybody, you're having a good time. What's going on with you? I actually just am noticing now and telling this to you that after 36 years of being a comedian, I don't go there anymore. But boy, oh boy, I used to actually point them out and talk to them. What's wrong with you? Now I don't care. I don't even notice. And that's interesting. I'll tell you, there's a great joke.
Tell me.
A woman comes up to a comedian, says she's going to have, she wants to have sex with him. She just thinks he's the greatest thing since sliced bread. She's going to do things to him that have never been done before. And she's gorgeous, and he's all excited. She says, I saw your show last night, and I want to be with you. And he says, did you see the first show or the second show? Because if she saw the show where he wasn't very good, something's wrong with her.
There is such a connection. The Greeks were right between tragedy and comedy.
Oh, yeah, yeah. They're. By the way, for me, how I get through life is laughing at tragedy. or finding humor in tragedy.
But you need the tragedy. You can't have the humor without the tragedy.
By the way, if you're easily offended, do not sit near comedians at a funeral. It's true. You know, a friend of mine just passed away, Bob Einstein, who was on Curb Your Enthusiasm, was also Super Dave. He he was on the, he wrote on the Smothers Brothers show. His partner was Steve Martin. Great stories for me through his years in comedy. And at his memorial, I had his voice in my head saying, why are they going on so long? I didn't even like them that much. Why are they speaking at my memorial? And that's the way he was a straight shooter. And I got him in my head saying that about certain people.
Oh, my God. Well, I remember Tom Sawyer, right?
Yeah.
The greatest comedian of all time pretty much was... what's the guy who wrote Mark Twain?
Yeah, Mark Twain. Yeah,
who talked about Tom Sawyer going to his own funeral because he actually survived and went in the back row and watched all these people coming to his funeral. It's the same kind of thing. How great would it be to one day be able to go to your own funeral? I got to tell you one Mark Twain story. My father loved Mark Twain. So supposedly, in his day, 1900, he's the Michael Jackson. He's the biggest rock star there ever can be. So he gets invited to speak in the South by the wealthiest man in North Carolina. He owns a bank, and he can't wait to show off to Mark Twain about how literate he is and how funny he is, how great he is. So at this big dinner honoring Mark Twain, and he's there to speak, and he puts him right next to him up on the dais, and he says to Mark Twain, excuse me, Mr. Twain, could you please pass me the sugar? And Mark Twain is this great wordsmith. So he's sure. So he passes the sugar. And he says to Mark Twain, you know, Mr. Twain, the word sugar is the only word in the English language that has an S-U pronounced the sh sound. And Mark Twain looks at him and goes, are you sure? Fantastic. All right, coming up next, we're going to continue. I want to hear.
Was he waiting with that little sound bite thing?
Yes, you know, eight years together. He knows every move.
I just got to think, if I ever did a stand-up set and every time I delivered a punchline, that thing came in, I don't know if I could finish. I'd be laughing so hard. So I'm sure the audience would be annoyed. All right, go ahead.
Annoying the audience is a good thing.
It's fun sometimes.
You're listening to the great Jeff Garland on the Weekend Warriors Show. The clinic, I'll open it up. What are these people doing in the gym that is destroying their rotator cuff? I'll explain coming up next on the Weekend Warriors Show. Now, why would the great Adam Bronstein be playing the Grateful Dead and Casey Jones? Because you're not only hearing the incredible voice of Jerry Garcia. By the way, what a delicious flavor that is for Ben and Jerry's. Cherry Garcia. Even though it's yogurt. Pseudo ice cream. But it's about Jerry Garcia. What a great voice. I remember hearing being interviewed where they asked him, you know, what are you going to do? He says, I know one thing. I'm not having a 9-to-5 job. And I got to figure out what I can do to not have a 9-to-5 job. That's exactly what Hobie Alter said. I want a job where I never have to cross over the 405 freeway. I want a job that keeps me between the 405 freeway and the beach. That's what you need to do. These are the parameters. Thank you, God, for giving me a life. But this is what the life is going to be. But Jerry Garcia, at age 4, went up to the bungalow that the family had in Northern California, and he and his older brother were chopping wood with an axe. So I think the brother was a couple of years older than him. So you got a 6-year-old with an axe with a 4-year-old little brother. Nothing good will come out of that scenario. And sure enough, his older brother, by accident, chopped off his long finger. And Jerry Garcia became one of the greatest guitar players in the world, despite that. And that is why Adam Bronstein is playing Grateful Dead music. The numbers for the station is 877-710-ESPN. Take advantage of this opportunity, Weekend Warriors. Certainly if you hurt your shoulder, your elbow, your hand, your wrist, I got the world's expert right now in studio. And I'm going to ask him a bunch of questions, but you can. The clinic will be open at 7:30, and I got to tell you about some of the cases that I did this week. One of them yesterday in an LAPD officer for his hip, which is just fascinating. But we'll get into that. But you can join the clinic, 877-710-ESPN at 7:30. But I want to take advantage right now of having the great Dr. Eugene Tsai. Eugene, thanks so much for waking up early to be with us.
Thank you so much for having me. Very excited to be here.
Let's get into it right away. What an idea of yours to choose to become a hand surgeon. Your dad was an architect. You grew up in Santa Monica. You went to the greatest medical school I can ever think of, the Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons, where I went to medical school. And I'm very proud of you for that. And very quickly, in these just 2 years, you really have distinguished yourself. Why did you pick hand surgery of all the things you could do as a surgeon?
It's a good question. I ask myself that a lot. You know, growing up, I played a lot of piano, performed a lot. So everything growing up kind of centered around my hands. But I didn't even know I wanted to be a doctor or anything like that. I just kind of went along with things and looked at where it took me. But as I started training and figuring out and having to figure out what I wanted to do, you know, I found I didn't want to ever be bored. Is one big thing. And when I looked at the hand and studying the hand, I found this is something that's so impossibly complex. There's just no way I'm ever going to be bored. And every day I still learn new things about the hand and how it works and the little intricacies of it. And that really drives me to continue to kind of refine my craft and see if we can do things better, because this is a impossibly complex machine that can always be improved.
I just love it when you guys open up the palm and open up the digits. It's kind of like my dad is a carpenter. Your dad is an architect. Me is a sculptor, an art history major. You as a piano player. You take the roof off. You take the sheetrock off the wall, and there you see the copper pipes, if you're in a good house, with the hot and cold water and the waistlines. Then you see the electrical wires going. You see the nerves, you see the arteries, you see the veins, you see the 2x4s, the wood, those are the bones. You start to see the clapper vision, you see it in construction. For a hand surgeon, it's just tinier and tinier. And at the very slight angle that the tendon crosses the joint makes the difference between it flexing the finger versus extending the finger. The whole idea of the lumbrical. It's fascinating to me. What exactly is... Explain to the weekend warriors, what the hell? We can understand, we can look at our own hands and see the tendons that extend and flex, but teach us what the hell a lumbrical is.
A lumbrical, one of the most strangest muscles in the human body. It's a muscle that comes off of an actual tendon itself. Nowhere else in the body that I can think of does a muscle come from a tendon, because all muscles are attached to bone.
Right.
It makes sense that way. And for some reason, we developed this muscle that comes off of a tendon, and it flexes down at your big knuckles and extends the rest of your finger. Why is that important? Well, if we didn't have these muscles, this lumbrical, we would only, as we made a fist, our fingers would start to close down on itself, and you wouldn't be able to wrap your hand around large cylindrical objects like a soda can.
Or a hammer.
Or a hammer. Exactly. Exactly. Because the tips of your, as you contract your fingers, the tips of your fingers would start to flex, and they would just keep flexing all the way down in your palm, but then you're not actually grabbing around anything when you do that. So that's how the lumbricals work, and it's incredible.
I have to, I'm high right now. It's like you just gave me a shot of heroin in my arm to just visualize that and imagine that. And here's the crazy part, Eugene. When something breaks, we call you. You now have to fix that machinery that is still over our head in terms of the design of it. That's why this is such a privilege to be a surgeon, because you actually have to improve on it. That's crazy.
Absolutely.
So take us through reattaching. A carpenter slices his thumb off. The names don't matter. We're not going to talk about anybody in particular. But take us through a power tool, a saw, slicing a thumb off with the bone and the tendon and the artery and the vein and the skin and the lumbrical and the muscles and the tendons. How the hell do you put that back on again?
So this was...
What's the sequence of events? What do you reattach first? What do you look at?
So his injury is unfortunately an injury we do see on a weekly basis, at least. And the thing about a saw blade is that it's not like a knife. It has a thickness to it, and it cuts wood by...
What's that called? The kilf?
A kerf.
Kerf.
The kerf of the blade. And
that's a good Scrabble word, by the way, because you usually end up with just four little letters and you can't use them, and you don't want to start with F, by the way.
That's right. So instead of having a clean cut, it actually removes a section of the wood as it cuts the wood. Mm-hmm. It eats away a section. So when it cuts a finger, it does the exact same thing. It removes a section of skin, tendon, bone, nerve, and blood vessel. And it's not a clean cut. And this is the challenge in this patient of putting him together. You know, it's not difficult to put the bones back together, you know, with some wires or plates and screws and things like that. The hardest thing is the blood vessels, because they get ripped apart. And what we call the zone of injury, which is the area that's been injured by this saw, is very large for these vessels. And in his case, it was very close to the tip of the thumb, and we always try to save the thumb as much as possible because it is such an important digit, probably the most important, arguably, in the hand. So he did not have any usable veins or arteries. And so while we attached everything else, and that wasn't too difficult, having to restore the blood flow was the challenge. And so the decision we decided to do was we created a pouch in the chest and used the blood flow of the chest to help see if we could improve the flow to the tip of the finger.
So he has no artery and vein. You're just attaching the bone, the tendons, and then you're making a small incision. So it's his right hand, let's say, into his left pec major area of the chest, right under the skin. And for 3 weeks, you stuck the tip of his thumb into that pouch.
Poor guy.
Oh,
I can't imagine.
God. And this comes from the Japanese. Why do the Japanese need to do this?
So the Japanese have a long tradition of this so-called super microsurgery. And that kind of came out of this fact that the Yakuza, or the Japanese mafia, as a punishment for anything, if you did something wrong as a Yakuza member, your punishment was to chop off a section of your small finger to show that you were penitent and, you know, it was as payment for doing something wrong. And so whenever people are in Japan are seen missing parts of fingers, the thought is, oh, maybe they are a Yakuza member and part of the mafia. And so for them, it's a big thing to be missing fingertips. And so they are probably the most aggressive in terms of reattaching these fingertips. And when you're talking about fingertips, you know, as the blood vessels go out from your heart out into your extremities and out into the fingertips, they get smaller and smaller and smaller as they branch. And so by the time you get to the fingertips, they are, you know, fractions of the size of a human hair. And to reattach that is extremely challenging. And so they've become experts at it and come up with different ways of doing it.
It's fascinating. Can you stay? Well, you're here, so of course you can stay. All right. I definitely want to talk about surgery I did this week, but I actually don't even want to talk about that right now because it's more fun to talk to Dr. Tsai about hand surgery. It's just so fascinating. To some extent, shoulder surgery that I do, knee surgery, it's just bigger, but it makes it harder if it's a hand case. We're going to get into that. Coming up next, you're listening to the one and only Weekend Warrior Show.